who or what were some of the greatest influences on you as a child?
Well, actually, I was born in Uniontown, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
But my father, who was an AME Zion pastor at the time, was appointed to Massillon, Ohio, St. James AME Zion Church. And that's where, therefore, basically I grew up. I think I was age 4 when we moved there. And we lived there then the rest of our days. And I did all my education in Massillon, Ohio, and then later Baldwin Wallace College and Oberlin College, and also in Ohio. Well, the greatest influences in my life were obviously, number one, my family, my sisters and brothers, but my mother and father in particular, the church, of which, of course, we were a part always. I was baptized 22 days old by the presiding, what was called the presiding elder in Dad's church in Uniontown. And therefore, very influential from the very beginning of my life was the presence of God, the love of God, the love of the neighbor as oneself. These were all quite important elements even before I knew how to walk or talk. And very early as in my own consciousness, these forces were rather powerful, even though at the time, as I've looked back across the years, I did not myself become really aware of the fact that this indeed was the presence of God, and later on then the call of God.
I know your life and the focus of your ministry has been much more than what can be described as a civil rights leader, but for a moment, let's talk about that. What motivated you, even in those early years, to begin to see those injustices and then to become kind of a foot soldier in the civil rights movement?
Well, there was no way for me to avoid the issues. I grew up in Ohio, where one, at a very early age, I learned one could be treated simply because of the color of my skin on the street, in the parking lot, even on the school ground. Consequently, very early in life, I had to make a decision. Was I a child of God, as my parents taught me? Did I belong? Was my life meant to be? Or do I accept these definitions of me that were quite hostile? So I was confronted at an early age, even before elementary school, to resist the name-calling that occurred, the insults that happened. These names and insults were not allowable in our home because they were not the language of humanity. They were not the language of love and respect for one another. So such words designating any kind of person, such words as curse words, this I never heard as a child in my own home, or for that matter in my congregation, and for that matter even in my neighborhood or school. We were to learn a language of respect. So I learned early to resist the slurs and the name-calling and the insults and the disrespect, and to treat myself with dignity, and then to learn to treat others with dignity. So that meant, therefore, for me, racism was not something that was segregation in the South. Racism and prejudice were things I faced in a community that was a good community to grow in, to be a child in, a good community to be a young person in. A safe community and secure community, so far as I'm concerned, as I look back very clearly upon it. The schools were at least desegregated. I won't say they were integrated. In some ways, they were integrated schools. We were maybe about 10% of the community of Massillon, Ohio. But there were black teachers in the school district, and generally speaking, things were open to the opportunity of any child, and consequently, without my knowing it, I received an excellent public school education from day one, so that I know what public education can be like in this society if there were a will for that. My father and mother were immigrants. Dad is the grandson and the great-grandson of escaped slaves from the United States who went into Canada. And as a very young preacher, Dad returned to the United States to eventually become a citizen and to work. My mother was a Jamaican, and at age 18, she came to the United States with a job in hand as a nanny. And there in Jamestown, New York, my parents met, and there they married. So those, my parents were not willing to take the prejudice and the fears and the segregations they had. So as a consequence, my father organized every place he pastored in New York and Pennsylvania. He organized either an Urban League or an NAACP if there were not one. So consequently, I learned in the 60s that it was my father who had founded the Urban League in Massillon, Ohio, an Urban League that continues. They were both members of the NAACP. So at an early age, age 16, I tried to obtain memberships from the community for and the church for the NAACP. So to resist the evil, I came to understand very early, was the essential responsibility of my life and of every human being.
And early on, you became a committed pacifist, and you've been active in the Fellowship of Reconciliation and that movement and others. What influenced you in that direction? Was that an early point in your life? And you might tell us about going to prison for those convictions during the Korean conflict, and also how you're going to India and the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi influenced you.
Well, in time, as I experimented with myself as a child of God, as a person who belonged to life, I came to understand that this was the call of Jesus in my life, the call of God through Jesus. And through the urging of my mother, in particular, I decided that fighting with my fist and with anger were not, for me, the best way. That I had to learn a better way of resisting wrong and dealing with persons who insulted and whatnot. And so that led me quietly, as an elementary school youngster, into experimenting with what then later on I came to call nonviolence. It was not until my teenage years, that I became aware of Gandhi, especially in the Negro newspapers of the time, which were always in our home. My calling in high school became very clear to me as a call of Jesus. The experiences in elementary school, I came to understand as God's way of claiming my life and Jesus' way of insisting that I was to follow him. And that became the paramount spiritual, moral, intellectual discipline of my life by high school days, and especially then college. And as that happened, and as I was turning the other cheek on racial slurs and insults, and then trying to win people over from their prejudices and exposing myself to allowing white youngsters to come to terms with the fact of my humanity as being equal to theirs, and therefore getting them to push out of their minds the junk that their parents or their community or even their congregation had taught them, I realized that this meant basically my life was going to serve the kingdom of God and Jesus, and that meant, therefore, there was no time for picking up civilian pursuits of various sorts, and that meant violence. In 1947, I met A.J. Musty of the Fellowship of Reconciliation in college. He came to lecture on the campus, and I was elated. It was a sanctifying moment for my life, because then I realized there was in Christian history a long tradition of some people, though not oftentimes the hierarchy and the theologians, and often not the pastors preaching and teaching it, but that there was, based on the life of Jesus, that edge of people who insisted that love was all embracing and all compelling, that therefore in the spirit of love, in the spirit of Jesus, one could not resist evil by imitating the evil, but by seeking to overcome the evil with good. So that threw me in a dither. It was easy for me to insist that, therefore, I would be resisting racism and sexism and later on violence and all their different dimensions. The struggle came as I recognized that there was a draft, and the United States had just emerged out of World War II, which I, as a junior high and high school student, supported in my youth. But that war itself was in opposition to Jesus, and that I could not therefore put on somebody's military uniform for the purpose of using arms against other human beings. I did wrestle with that extensively. At age 18, I registered for the draft, but I did so with reservation, when simply went to the post office and filled out a form. But I wrote across the form, "I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing. I'm wrestling with this issue. It may very well be that I may have to change it, this registration, if I discover that by conscience I could not register for the draft." So what that meant was that in 48-49, I came to the conclusion that to follow Jesus meant I definitely had to oppose war and violence and militarism and the like. And so I sent my draft cards back to the local board. That meant that in 1950, the FBI arrested me, and in 1951, I was tried in the federal court in Cleveland, Ohio, and sentenced to 3 years in prison. 47 was also important because I began to read the writings and the autobiography of Mohandas K. Gandhi, and began to wish, out of that experience, and then out of the experience of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which founded Congress on Racial Equality, to try to begin to work on public accommodations, I recognized that the battle against racism and segregation would be one of my concerns as a pastor, as a follower of Jesus. And I understood myself then as wanting one day to perhaps work in the South. I began to hope that in the United States many people would discover the superior form of struggle, nonviolent politics, nonviolent conflict, and that this would become something that increasingly people of color would use, and that especially the Negro would use in the United States. So this meant that, therefore, I went to prison in 1951, April of 1951. I was deeply committed by that time to find ways in which I could help break the back of segregation and racism in all of its forms.
You soon came to Nashville not long after that, and U.S. Congressman John Lewis, in his autobiography, describes you as the architect of the nonviolent direct action strategy of the evolving civil rights in the 1960s for training leadership. And in his book, David Halberstam refers to you often as the teacher. And he said at one point you were teaching the power of love. What were you teaching? And the second kind of question would be, are you teaching that same thing today?
Well, I remain a committed, baptized person of the church. I remain one who wrestles with what it means to follow Jesus in the 21st century. This is my personal journey. It's my journey, continuing journey in the community of faith. My Gandhi studies did lead me to join the Board of Missions of the Methodist Church as a missionary candidate. And initially in 1950-51, I was accepted to go to Africa, to what is now Zimbabwe, to teach in a high school, to teach and coach in a high school. But the prison term interfered with all of that. And so, but I continue to want to go overseas. So consequently, I wrote the Board of Missions and indicated that if and when I was paroled or released from jail, I would still want to go overseas. And an opportunity came then in 1952, to go to India, Hislop College, Nagpur, which I took, and I was there then for 3 years as a Methodist missionary, campus minister, helping and organize the World Student Christian Federation in India and what was then Ceylon, and also as a coach, coaching basketball and football and tennis and track and field. I returned from there to Oberlin Graduate School of Theology in 1956, and followed the course of the events. The Montgomery bus boycott was still going on then, and but felt again that I would one day work in the South. So I dropped out of school in 1957, and in January of 1958, I was in Nashville as the Southern Secretary for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which meant immediately I was traveling in the troubled spots of the South, Little Rock and Memphis and Jackson and Birmingham and Charlottesville, North Carolina, Danville, Virginia, Charlottesville, Virginia, South Carolina, Columbia, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Montgomery, Alabama, and so forth. Along the way, it became clear to me that while the Montgomery bus boycott was a powerful and effective matter in using soul force or nonviolence, that we needed to demonstrate the next stage. We needed to demonstrate the efficacy of nonviolence. And so with a group of colleagues in Nashville, Tennessee, I joined the Nashville Christian Leadership Council Executive Board as the chairperson of Direct Action. And through many, many conversations and workshops, we decided we would launch a nonviolent movement in Nashville to desegregate downtown Nashville, which meant that in the fall of 1959, we began workshops on nonviolence. And those workshops were a kind of a summary review of what nonviolence was about, using strategies of Gandhi, the Congress of Racial Equality from the United States, the Freedom Rides from the 1840s of the United States, especially the Montgomery bus boycott. We did a review of nonviolence from the point of view of Jesus and the Bible. We made it clear that nonviolence was not something secret or hidden, but that it was in almost every generation of the human race from the very beginning, though it was not called that. I also examined how Gandhi had made a great contribution by codifying nonviolence, by giving it a name, not pacifism, but nonviolence, by defining it as, indeed, a way of resisting injustice and cruelty and violence through the best values that the human race knows anything about, compassion and God and soul force and truth. And those are some of the things, of course, that I taught. I taught some of the weapons and techniques of nonviolence, all of this taking place as we were preparing then to do sit-ins in downtown Nashville as our first step towards desegregating that city.
Maybe you could give an illustration, a specific illustration of at that particular time of an example of what you would have taught in terms of nonviolence response.
Well, I did not just simply give examples of it. I showed I had people engage in what we called role playing, where I gave them real life episodes that they were asked to act out. There were many, many illustrations. I gave used the illustration of Jesus in the Luke Gospel, chapter 4, his visit to his home city, a village of Nazareth, where after reading the book of Isaiah and beginning to teach from it, we have only a little part of the story that could be best remembered and eventually written down, I suppose. But Jesus is confronted with a very angry group of home people who literally take him out of the city, intending to throw him off of the precipice and to stone him for his blasphemy. And as this is described in Luke, it's clear to me that Jesus resists them not with losing his cool or with anger or with trying to run, escape, or with passivity. But the way Luke describes it is that he walked through the midst of them and went on his way. And I discovered around this period of time, in the late 50s, early 60s, that John Wesley performed that same stunt 5 or 6 times in his tours of England preaching. He was confronted by similar mobs of men. On one occasion at least, they dragged him by his hair through the street. And John Wesley taught me how to face a mob, because he describes in his journal how with great instincts of love he tried to stay on his feet. On one occasion, I recall, he threw off his hat so people had to look him in his face, and he himself tried to catch a sense of who were the leaders in the mob. And then he tried to find a way of addressing one of those leaders with a question that probed the leader past that which the leader was trying to commit against Wesley's person. And so I taught that in the late 50s and 60s. And
your activities
still teach
in
them.
Of
beg
course,
pardon?
Got you in trouble. You were a student at Vanderbilt, and we all know, and I've read in numerous places the fact of your expulsion from Vanderbilt. I'm sure that was as you look back on your life, a point that sticks in your memory in a vivid way.
Of course, I remember it, but also, though, far more important was the fact that I recognized in Nashville that in that work and in the struggle that began to emerge, I was fundamentally doing God's will. I was following Jesus in a fashion that was consonant with the spirit and the heart that I had met across the years through the scriptures and elsewhere. So the clear part of spiritual development is the notion that if you try to stand for the truth and for the right, if you stand with love, there are times when, of course, you will be persecuted and harassed, and there are times where, in fact, you can be jailed and expelled from school. So the expulsion from Vanderbilt took place as that movement hit its power and its stride in February and March of 1960 in Nashville. And my expulsion from school was without a hearing, no due process, though I was a graduate student in the School of Religion and a student in very good standing. And in addition to that, the faculty was not consulted by the small executive committee of the university that did the action. But that's, in another way, that's a rather marvelous story, because I remained firm in the struggle. Dorothy and I lived through those days with, I think, a great amount of poise and dignity. We found ourselves growing, our lives being enriched and enlarged by the presence of God. We've both lived to have luncheon then with the chancellor of the university, who was at the center of that expulsion, and to confirm the fact that we had no animosity towards him, and for him to indeed confess to us that this was something that should never have happened. So what went around came back around in a new spirit.
I'd like for you to say a word about Dr. Martin Luther King. Your life intersected with him, and
yes,
I believe you're close in age. While you shared the same passion, you came from somewhat different backgrounds. What was your relationship with him? How did he influence you? And you both spoke of the beloved community. You shared a common vision. What one or two memories or impressions of his life, as it intersected with yours, could you share with us?
I met Martin Luther King Jr. Around December the 6th, 1955, through the front page of the Nagpur Times in India, where a major story on the front page was of the Negroes marching, boycotting in Montgomery, Alabama. That, of course, was a big story in India, the land of Gandhi. And Martin Luther King was the newly selected president of the Montgomery Improvement Association, the MIA, which was the organization that was formed on December the 2nd, to become the vehicle to conduct the bus boycott that began on December the 5th. I shook his hand then around February the 6th, 1957, at Oberlin College, where he came to speak. And I had been invited by Harvey Cox, the campus minister, to be in the small private dinner after his speech, so that I would have a chance to meet Martin King. And he and I arrived within about 10 seconds of each other in that dining room. And so we visited. And we discovered we had a a number of things in great common, he a Baptist, my a Methodist. But most of all, we recognized that we had a common commitment to soul force as the way to help the United States transform itself into a purer form of equality and liberty and justice for all. And at one point in our conversation, I said that since the late 40s, I had thought one day I would work in the South, and maybe when I completed the theological education I wanted, I might come directly south. And Martin, without meeting a beat, said to me, "Come now, don't wait, we need you now." And then he went on to say that there was not a clergy person in the South with my depth of experience in nonviolence or my study in nonviolence. So I recognized that as another moment in which I was being called from beyond myself by eternity. And so I very quietly, though I did not know what I was saying, and though I did not know how this would happen, I said, "I will come as soon as I can." So I'll not forget that. So Martin King and my life then were intertwined from that time until his death April 4th. And of course, I was in Memphis at that time as pastor at Centenary Methodist Church and happened to be chairman of the strategy committee for the sanitation strike. The strategy committee was the community union committee that worked together and managed basically the entire strike, and the community had asked me to be the chair, so I did. So I saw Martin the last day of his life, April the 4th, 1968, at the Lorraine Motel on two occasions. By that time, I had come to sense that Martin King was God's extraordinary prophet for that part of the 20th century in the United States, if not the world. He was by that time the symbol of a massive movement, and at the same moment articulated nonviolence and justice and the best of the American promise in words that even today, and I reread some of them yesterday on his birthday, words that even today are prophetic and powerful and faithful to God's spirit and faithful to the best visions that we the people have had about ourselves on these shores. He was a marvelous friend and brother. I relished our personal conversations on a number of occasions. I marched behind him on a number of occasions. When I, at the invitation of this Memphis movement, at the request of the Memphis movement, approached him about one day coming to Memphis to speak to a mass meeting, he agreed immediately, with our only problem being how he would work it out from the hectic schedule that was his from December the 1st, 1955, till April the 4th, 1968. He was a man who loved to sing, to dance, to eat, to preach, to teach. He loved athletics. On our staff retreats, we played basketball or football, touch football. We went swimming, walked the beaches, and So King was an ordinary man who accepted an extraordinary calling and did that with great faithfulness. I think it is tragic for the church in the United States and for millions of Christians for not to hear or recognize the voices of Martin Luther King Jr., in my judgment, is to not hear or recognize the voice of God in the prophets Isaiah or in the prophet Jesus.
Dr. King certainly addressed so many more things than just racial injustice, as you have throughout your ministry. And you've often said that the civil rights movement was a human movement that
yes.
sought to heal the people of America and to proclaim a different kind of society. Say more about that.
Yes, one of the effects of racism and sexism and also of violence, and I think to a more limited extent, but also of religious bigotry, is that we so particularize a group of people that we do not see them as being a part of the human family. And then at the same moment, we then, especially in the Western world, become subject to a kind of arrogance in which we think ourselves to be superior to that particular group of people with which we have in that fashion rejected. The black movement in the United States, at its best, has always been a part of the heroic struggle of the American people to make our constitutional visions and vision of the Declaration of Independence become real and true. We say we're a democracy, but we've never arrived at it. Let's say an 80% level of being a democratic society. Because from the beginning, we decimated Native Americans. We established slavery for 250 years. And then we never acknowledge women as being equal and human. So they were always relegated to the control of the male. And that's still being taught by many churches. Well, the struggle of the Negro for change has therefore been a struggle to get America to become America for everyone. Women, all people of color, and in my own ministry, especially children, must become equal in our sight before God.
Having spent a lifetime protesting war, are you disheartened about the climate in the nation and the world today?
The whole push of our nation today for war and the mayhem that you see in our own country and around the world astonishes me. I am particularly grieved over my own nation's role in this, because we have been the most powerful, wealthiest nation that the human journey has ever had. And we began with such high idealism. In spite of our flaws, we've had this remarkable idealism which so much of the world has applauded for centuries and then often in the 20th century tried to emulate in different respects. But the world in large measure is a world in which the United States has had the central influence. It's a world largely of our own making. Just let me give you one illustration of this. Whether we like it or not, for the last 20, 30 years, we've been the number one, well, actually since World War I, we've been the number one armaments maker and bomb maker in the world. In the last 30 years, we've been the primary exporter of this. We make more money out of selling guns and landmines and bombs and airplanes and helicopters and napalm. We make more money from that than any nation has ever made from war. And we have exported that around the world. We have military missions in over 100 nations now. No empire of the past has rivaled that. Our major budget at a federal national level is the budget of war, past, present, future. And that has now come to a zenith, I believe, in the present administration that has for more than 12 months now, for 15 months now, been preaching war as the major message. I think people of religion ought to ask ourselves the question, what goes on in a nation where the major message in the media, from the White House and the Congress and the Pentagon and the CIA, is our right to make war on other people? God has not given us such a right. We have the power because God has given us power. But we have no such right. So I grieve over this. I rejoice, however, in the fact that already millions of voices are speaking otherwise. The current issue of Time magazine says that in their recent poll, 72% of the American people say we should not go to war against Iraq. That's phenomenal. And then I know in Los Angeles, we have various groups of people from all walks of life and all creeds and many colors and complexions and national origins. We have them engaged in prayer meetings and outdoor vigils on street corners and small marches and picket lines and civil disobedience all around our county. Congregations waking up, Jewish and Protestant and Catholic and Buddhist and Muslim and Hindu, saying religion must not bless war and violence, but we must only bless peace and justice and truth and a faith that embraces every man and every woman, every boy and every girl, no matter where they are or who they are or what they are. So I take great heart in that. And on January the 18th, in honor of Martin Luther King, there will be large demonstrations in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, many prayer vigils. There will be large demonstrations in Europe and in Canada. So I take heart in the fact that ordinary people recognize that we can have a better world, that this is the message of Jesus, the message of Martin Luther King, the message of Muhammad, that we human beings are not destined to destroy ourselves or the earth with a whimper or a bang, that we can have a better world, and that we have to then begin to speak up and to break our silence and to break our fears, no matter who we are, and begin to tell our elected officials and our business, big business corporations, our war profiteers, our Pentagon and CIA, enough is enough. It's time to turn our money, our technology, our vitality, our creativity, our human resources to feeding the hungry, to breaking down the barriers of racism and sexism and violence, and begin to wage more energetically than any war can be waged, to solving the human problems out of which the world, the human family, can have a great, urgent, new burst of what it is to be human and alive. And I know that to be God's will. I know that to be the message of Jesus.
Are you optimistic about the United Methodist Church as an institution, as it struggles with its great diversity to address some of these issues and to, in fact, be a part of the spiritual and moral revolution? I know you've had a great history with the United Methodist Church. You've been a General Conference delegate numerous times. You established Black Methodists for Church Renewal. You worked in so many areas of the church. You know the church, the institutional church, the United Methodist Church, intimately. And you've represented it abroad and so forth. What is your feeling about the future of the church and its ability to do some of the things you're talking about?
Well, I'm full of hope on the one side. My sense of the United Methodist Church and where it is and all, on the one side of the coin, I am a person of hope, because though he slay me, yet will I trust God. I know that to be the concrete meaning of my life. But I think the United Methodist Church has been under assault for the last 30 years at least, from those people within the church who have called us leftists and communist, especially in the 70s, the 60s and 70s. And now they call us heretical. And the bishops and the leadership of the church, especially the white leadership of the church, have not known how to handle that assault. And so there's a fair amount of silence and anxiety and fear. In addition, it's my judgment that, like the nation as a whole, we have tended to select too many leaders of more of a mediocre style than our best preachers, our best theologians, our best academicians, our best pastors, our finest lay characters. And that's hurting the church today desperately, because when the world is in crisis and where human life is on the brink with many disasters already going on, you have to have some creative minds and hearts who dare to think outside the box, not in terms of a 19th century theological or spiritual journey, but in terms of how is the Word of God addressing the human race and addressing us today. And in that sense, I am dismayed, though I am not pessimistic about it, because I know full well that there are all kinds of people in our pews who want to be faithful to Jesus. And if we, the preachers and the teachers and the pastors and the bishops, could get our own eyes lifted, there could be the United Methodist Church could refind its soul and go onward into the challenge of carrying out urgent work that needs to be done today. We do not need to become a confessing church. We do not need to become a fundamentalist church. We need to become a church that is filled with the Spirit of Jesus, even like a Martin Luther King Jr., and I would dare to say like any number of Methodists that I've known across the years and know today who have informed my own life.
I think you've done an excellent job of covering an awful lot of territory and space. And is there anything else that you can think of that you would certainly want to include or feel like that's absent from this?
May I just say that I'm very grateful to God for the fact that I grew up as a Methodist. I think the Wesleyan message, John Wesley's notion of mission, and his being captive to the love of God as an overwhelming, transforming power in his life that called him to join God in the transformation of the earth. His witness to the power of the scripture and reason and its tradition and experience. To me, I think this is a form of Christianity that the world desperately needs. And it's one of the reasons why I am a Methodist and remain a Methodist and have never threatened that I'm going to leave the church. From my point of view, that's not a possibility. And the folk who threaten us with leaving the church, you know, one day the bishops ought to say, well, go ahead and leave and let us go on about the task of the work, that the urgent work that God has given all people of faith, in my judgment, to do today, to reject the leadership of nationalism pointing us towards war and division and hostility and the demonizing of one or many people, but to look to the direction of Jesus and thereby to heal the wounds, to call people to life, and to make clear that the earth is the Lord's and that the future belongs to God and not to the mismanagement of the earth. That, it seems to me, is a task that we have yet to do.